about that because of the budget restrictions, how funded out of different funding envelope. If you look here, we are making progress in all the sites, and in fact, in Kanda A and Babalani and Abazimbi, we already have students in them. The next slide, slide just deals with who these colleges of these campuses belong to. You see the links to each of the previous colleges that are in existence. We are not envisaging creating any new colleges at this stage. We are rather expanding the campus footprint. For the more technically minded, there's the financials at this stage. Bear in mind this is as of quarter two. In actual fact, we've just crossed the Rubicon. We're at 52% of expense and 52% roughly on physical implementation. The anticipated completion dates, which are listed there, are those on the contract. In reality, these change, and many of these sites, in fact, are going to be finished in the latter part of next year. The extensions of time normally come about because of issues relating either to we also gave an indication, I think, after our last presentation, there was a request to can we do a gender breakdown. You can see the gender breakdown on the right-hand column. At this stage, in terms of the local labour employment, we have 150 recorded for female and 669 for male. There's our footprint. That is what we're adding to the system. It's 2,880 seats. Regrettably, the original plan would have added in excess of 10,000 seats, but we've actually had to cut this footprint because of budgetary restraints. So at present, the sites are moving along as well as we can say under the current environment, especially in regards to labour. And we are in fact anticipating at least two of the sites in the second half of next year, early in the second half next year, to be handed over. What is important to note is that the relationship between this project and the municipality is a very tight one, and where that is kept in place, we are able to maintain the stability of the site. And then for those of you who would like some physical evidence, there's some pictures of the construction. They actually are much further than this now because of the 2 months or so that have gone past. There you can see on the first Zakuru. It's not nice, you can't see the detail. But that's our admin block on the left. On the right is Nongoma, which is a workshop under construction. And on the slide up there now, that is just a basic construction of the early phase, showing foundations and things like that. So, Chair, that ends my presentation. I'll hand over to Dyke. Program, and the other one is the new university development program. Institutions are not able to manage their contracts properly, they are overrun, and meet with the institution on a quarterly basis so they can see
that a further 480 million is going to be provided to support further student housing infrastructure. So this is a commitment by government to add to the funding that is in the baseline already for infrastructure in our institutions. And the amount that's been made available now is for both universities and community colleges, not just for universities. I think that's a very important aspect. We're also working with other departments, the Department of Public Works, Human Settlements, the Housing Department of Infrastructure Development and Housing, to identify possible land and buildings that could be converted. This is a long-term project we're talking about, but already we've seen some movement in terms of approach. So at the moment, the projects that are happening currently, these are underway. The Nelson University, Fortier, Wild Technology, large scale student housing projects, and we've got a next set of projects where we're already working on feasibility studies, and they will be in place soon. And as we roll out, we'll be seeing these large scale developments happening across the So as we go forward, these are the next ones that we've identified and we'll be working with. But we think that we'll prepare a pipeline of projects each year, and going forward we're putting in place a student housing infrastructure program management office, which is linked to our agreement with CPSA and National City. One of the things I neglected to say, Honourable Chairman, is that CPSA has identified a 6 billion loan fund facility to support this program. So we are finding some traction with it and recognising the importance of student housing. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we'll just take on the of the grant, University of USA. Thank you. 2017, if you look at the subsidy per individual student or per individual SDE, that has been completely flat even before you take inflation into account. So it's an indication that we are heading to a crisis. And when Dr. Parker presented the slide on maintenance, what universities do is really make sure that the academic programs are funded. And then, of course, the shortfall really going to what they hope will be dealt with at a later stage. So maintenance, of course, is something that really collapsed, new infrastructure collapsed, kind of in terms of new building of new infrastructure. So just to say that underfunding is a reality, and Pavel will also kind of indicate with of course, we have high levels of instability. We are deeply concerned about students and staff well-being and safety. We have another tragic event in the University of Free State this week, when another young student passed away from violence. And so we are deeply concerned about that. And we have issues of governance in our institutions, which we have to work at. Not clearly, not all institutions, but many more institutions do function well, but there are some which are really struggling. And I think we have to speak about, we haven't heard, unfortunately, about the deeply fractured schooling system. We have all the discussions about the post-industrial revolution and so on. I don't buy into all that, I have to be honest with you. Just to give you one piece of information, that if you look at the number of students, about 60% of women in mathematics in 2016, 2017, 2018 declined. So, if we don't get the school system to function well, there's just no chance of making progress.
Thank you. then we have to discharge. At the moment, as I mentioned earlier, the throughput rate is about 60%, but we need to get that up to 80% by 2030. There's a lot of really exciting work going on in this area, and in particular around the use of data and data analytics, right, to identify students at risk and to try and intervene early on in the life cycle of students. But more importantly, I want to also mention that there are huge efforts to try and improve the teaching that goes on in our university. So, I'm not certain that we'll get to that 80% target, but we are making progress. There's been a gradual but steady improvement in the throughput rate. Whether we'll get to the 80% by 2030, I'm not sure. The NDC requires 75% of academic term PhDs by 2030. We are currently sitting at 45%, and this is a challenge. It's not clear to me we're going to make that target. And it requires us to have 5,000 PhDs per annum, and we currently produce 3,400 PhDs. We had a dramatic increase since about 2010, a very dramatic increase. It was in the region of about 1,000 in 2010. We're now sitting at 3,400. There are questions about quality and all of that, but still, there's a trajectory, and we have to try and maintain that trajectory. So what are the big challenges and opportunities, right? So one is clearly the idea that we have to broaden access, but what we can't do is just bring young people into the system without also ensuring access, right? So and of course, you know, as we move into this new terrain of using technology to broaden access, we're going to be facing a lot of challenges there. And it's not clear to me that we're really grappling with this enough yet. And it's going to require investment, significant investment. We really do need new articulation pathways within the post-school education training sector and the public-private education sector. The idea has to be that actually those two systems sit in the post-school education system, the TEDC sector and the IKS sector, have to speak to each other in a much more direct way than they are at the moment. And I think that's something that universities are working at, but we really need a national solution to this. I don't think it's going to happen just on an ad hoc basis, if you like. And then I think that would be a great risk for us to have the private and public sector kind of move in opposite directions or move in parallel directions. I think that we have to get them to become part of a single education system. I mentioned earlier the use of data analytics in the service of student success and growth. When I say growth, I mean student growth, if you like. But I want to say that for some universities are doing brilliantly, others are doing badly, and it has got to do with the availability of resources and so on. And I think that we have to think quite hard about how to ensure that this becomes a national project. The next one is the issue around lifelong learning. And the reason I mention this is because when we talk about this new technology moment that we are in, it is going to require a constant renewal of kind of knowledge and information and so on. So graduates, I think, will have to be constantly upgraded, will have to constantly upgrade themselves. And the only way that we can do that is through lifelong learning enterprise. We've been talking about this since 1986, and we haven't made much progress. But now is the time. And partly because there are going to be new forms of credentialing that will come into play in the near future with the kind of the fourth industrial revolution or whatever you want to call it. The story, you know, is that if you go to Google for a job, you know, Google don't ask you what qualification you have, they ask you what have you done, what courses have you taken, and so on. You know, so the whole idea around credentialing is going to be a very big kind of change for universities as we head into the future. And then, of course, there's a big challenge around language and access, and I'm not going to spend much time on that, but it's a really critical issue. On the research and innovation side, I've mentioned already that we produce about 3,400 PhDs a year. We produce 24,000 peer-reviewed research articles per annum. By the way, that's 1% of the global output. That's way of outflows that have reduced globally. What that means is that even though we've had a massive growth in outflows, the quality of our research outputs is still of very good quality. The quality is still very high. So I just want to repeat that. So we have a 10% share. We have a 1% share of the global outputs, but we have a 10% share of the top decile of the most cited articles in the world. And of course, as Dr. Parker mentioned earlier in her talk, there are concerns around the ethics of research and ethics of publishing and so on. But it by no means is the dominant kind of feature of the research system, and it's something that we have to deal with. And this graph really shows you this growth that we see. This figure of 15,000 is really equates to the 24,000 because this really refers to units of publication. So in other words, if a South African publishes an article with somebody from Ghana, say, that counts as half, and that's where it comes down to 15,000. But we actually produce 24,000. And the yellow points there indicate the share that we have of the global output. And this really refers to kind of the extent to which our quality has grown between 2000 and 2016. The orange point really points towards the exposure, the citation visibility of other research publications. And the green one drops to 2000, and the orange one to 2016. And you can see that in all cases, except in the case of humanities, we've made big progress in that direction. That's a very good sign, because even though we have growth, there's also high quality. What are the key areas of strength? Biomedical and physical science is by far our biggest area of research strength, 16% output. Business, economics, management, scientific, 10%, and then, I won't go through it. We have that. Just some detail, 55% of our research output are in collaboration with international researchers and institutions. Now, that's a good and a bad story, because what it means is that we are a highly connected high education system. The question is, what is our contribution to that? Who's shaping the research question, and so on. So that's a figure that needs to be interrogated, and we need to kind of study that figure. We don't really know yet, what should the collaboration profile be in terms of international institutions, until we do a kind of study of this. What I can tell you is that if you go back to the biomedical physical science, we are very dominant there. We play a very big role. So in that case, it's a good situation. On the other hand, I'm a physicist. I work in the area of particle physics, theoretical particle physics. It would be really wrong to imagine that if there's strong collaboration, that's bad, because actually that branch of physics is a very international branch. So 30% of our research output is by women researchers, 32% by black researchers, so there's been big changes there. And 25% of our researchers are about to be the 50. That last 50 years old. The last one is, of course, a big concern to us, because what we really have to focus on now is the next generation. We're trying to make sure that the next generation is coming through the system, that they are productive, they are involved in research, that they are passionate about research, and that's a challenge for us. This next graph is really a graph about what we refer to as the gross domestic expenditure on R&D. It's in millions of rand, and as you can see, if you look at the blue dots, you can see that there's been an increase in funding, gross expenditure, I should say. There's been an increase in gross expenditure on R&D. We've gone all the way from 7.5 billion in 2001 to 35.7 billion in 2016. But if you do that calculation on the basis of kind of the value of the rand in 2010, what you see is that it's completely flat. It's been low. And that's a very concerning feature. By the way, what that does is that it puts us business on research and development. And what we are seeing is a decline in the funding of research by R&D. By the way, this is a really bad sign, because everywhere else in the world where you've got big kind of manufacturing industry, where you've got big kind of innovation going on, it's the business sector that really dominates the expenditure on research and development. And in our case, we've now dropped below, in the terms of, we've now dropped below the expenditure of government on R&D. And that's a really worrying concern, and we have to pay some attention to that. We have to find some ways of changing that. The other thing that's worrying us a little bit is the fact that 11.14%, the figure is slightly wrong now, if you look at the 2017-2018 figure, about 14% of our research spend is from international sources. So it will be a really big disaster for us, in fact, if we have too much of growth in the international spending and a decrease in business spending, that would be quite a tricky situation for us. On the other hand, it indicates in fact that our researchers are competitive globally in accessing the funding for research. The next one tells us in fact that if you look at the blue line, the upper blue line, what it tells you is that at the moment we have about 57,000 researchers in headcount. So in other words, of the number of people who are doing some level of research, it's about 58,000. If you do the FTU, if you work out what is the fraction, if you determine what the fraction is of each of those people, what fraction of their time do they spend on research, and then that comes down to about 28,000. But here's the really tricky issue. The tricky issue is that those figures include the number of PhDs, include the PhDs and the master students. And what this tells us then is that we've actually had a decline in real terms. So the number of researchers in Oxford has actually come down over the period of time. So we have to be really worried about it. I'm going to skip this slide because it's really talking about, we've spoken about already, a whole range of opportunities for us, you know, in terms of research, kind of the changes in the research system due to the kind of new technology moments, if you like, across the country, and the quality. And I think that we are on top of this, but there's still kind of lots of opportunities for us to improve them. I'll leave this with you to just give you a sense of what the annual improvement, the average annual improvement, or the compounded annual average improvement is on different indicators, and I'll leave that with you to look at. Just some final thoughts, Chair. Where should we be focusing? It seems to me the one place we should be focusing on is postgraduate funding. And from my point of view, that we really need a national workable strategy, and we really have to think of this as a social justice. We fund young people to come into the system to do undergraduate studies and then we give them time. It's a drop off. We can't have it. A certain percentage of those young students will go into the labor market, others will want to continue, and we really have to have a system that provides for that. The NRS is not the right body for that. The NRS has a different agenda. There needs to be a national workable strategy to deal with the issue of postgraduate funding. By the way, the sustainability of the high education system is totally dependent on broadening that postgraduate pipeline. If we crack down on that pipeline, there's just no possibility then that we're going to have the production of knowledge that we seek in our national system. Not just the high education system, but the general system. And then finally, just to say that we want to create a new pipeline, a broadened pipeline for the new generation of academics, then we better make sure that they eventually in postgraduate education. At the level of undergraduate education, we are of course deeply concerned about the sustainability of the current PhD bursary models. We think it's a fantastic model. We think that it's a model that's going to have a huge impact on social mobility, on success rates, and so on. I think I should just, as has been mentioned before, undermine the sustainability of this building model. All the indications are that these countries are worrying. Let's hope that that's not the case. I'm fully supportive of Dr. Carlson's huge improvement in the functioning of this one, but we do need a new financial aid ecosystem. You're perfectly correct. The long before students come to the university, they should have the travel allowance, they should have the in some universities, the first tranche of money only comes into the students March, which is the last of the year. In some cases, so I think that this is a very useful issue, and we've spoken about missing middle funding for missing middle students. Essentially saying there's no money in front of the African government, because we can't have a situation where there are young people who are fully qualified to come to university instead of opportunity. Any young person that comes fully qualified to come to university should have an opportunity. On the issue of funding and teaching, issue around differentiation, articulation across the preset sector. And what I mean by that really is that we really have to be clear about what the role of the TBT sector is, what the role of the university sector is, what is the role of the research intensive universities or the teaching intensive universities, how do we make sure that it all fits together into a single system. By the way, in the university sector, we are completely and acutely aware that if the TBT sector doesn't work, the university doesn't. Since the sustainability of universities will not be there if the TBT sector doesn't work, we have to think of this as a single functioning system, if you like. We have to think quite hard about the realistic, we are doing already, we're trying to get a realistic assessment of the actual cost of graduating students. We don't know yet what are the costs of the new engineering. The test study was not done in about 1988. So we have to repeat that, and we have to do that calculation so that we have a decent idea of what the funding model should be. We have to look at the investments for new modes of delivery. The idea that we're going to have 650,000 new students in new universities is off the table. Unless something dramatic happens to our economy and all hope that that's the case, that's not going to be the case. So we really have to think about massive investment. We have to reduce the student-staff ratios, especially at the ACI and at the University of Technology. Just give you one statistic. The University of Cape Town, the student-staff ratio is about 14 to 1 or something like that. At DUC, where I was, that figure is about 40 to 1. So, and by the way, the students at DUC are the ones that require intensive teaching, intensive learning. I'm not suggesting that we should change the balance of UCT, I'm just saying that we should change the balance of the other institutions. So I'll skip that. Funding for research and innovation, I just want to say that actually we have to get the gross expenditure up to 1% of GDP and by 2021 and 1.5% by 2020. We want a sustainable research system, that's what we have to do. You'll hear from Dr. Kubela how the MRI is struggling. I think that we really have to have instruments in place to get more private sector investment in education. By the way, we had this, we had instruments which were taken away, which were kind of removed. Those instruments were hugely successful in building partnerships between the private sector and universities. Just one of the programs, sort of good program, was 150 million that investments from the government. And it generated 600 million rand of money. That has been removed now. So we have to go back to science. We have to rebuild the scientists in terms of FTE meaning researchers. At the moment, we have declined, we have to try to do that. And we have to think about when you have your conversations with the Department of Science and Innovation and the Minister, the one thing that I think we have to talk about is the national system of innovation. It's just a policy document at the moment. It doesn't exist. I don't know if you hear that it exists, but actually, the Science Council operates on their own universities operate on their own. You know, the private sector policies are just, shambles. We need a national system of relations. And my last slide is, Chair, we have to strengthen all aspects of private infrastructure. If we have any hope of like, catching this new technology moment, we have to invest in the private infrastructure. We need more and more bandwidth, international bandwidth. We need a lot of data to come down. Everybody needs to have access to data, not just the students and staff, but everybody. We have to think about a properly funded national infrastructure plan in terms of equipment and so on, looking at maintenance and so on. And then we are working quite hard and trying to understand how to create a shared services platform for all 26 universities, so that we can think about technology solutions which are national needs. With that, Chair, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Chair. Very interesting.
people talk all sorts of amendments on that resolution. I just simply talk about the transformation of the economy, whether they're working in the primary sector potentially, or whether they're going on to the fourth, the fifth, or whatever. All of them are based on knowledge. The transformation of the economy is based on knowledge. And that transformation is chairperson dependent on the ability and capacity of knowledge institutions and individuals. And that's why we believe it's absolutely important, chairperson, for us as a country to invest in our institutions, in our individuals, and in the knowledge enterprise itself, not of course in the national system of innovation. But if we don't do that, then we will not, in essence, determine our own destiny. Somebody else will. Providing the three new chairperson a lot of data. It is not intended for me to go through all of it, but the last time I had the privilege of meeting the portfolio committee chair, there were a lot of questions about detail. So that information is there, particularly in the context. But I just want to give a context. I'm going to say that we are a productive system. We're a very small system, very fragile and very, very small. And just to give context, 55,000 heads in terms of full-time and part-time, only 19,000 are full-time. Out of that 55,000 part-time and full-time, only about 13,500 have got doctoral degrees. Those are the people who are able to participate in the knowledge system. The distribution you can see in terms of inclusion, in terms of race, and you will clearly see that we are a relatively small system. Some of our institutions that have a very, what I would call, low number of individuals with doctoral degrees, and therefore their ability to participate in the knowledge enterprise is limited. With regard to the distribution of where those individuals are, this is in terms of full-time equivalent, you will notice that that's partly why he mentioned that we are high in business economic and management studies, that the highest proportion are in business, economic and management studies. And would be maybe not surprised, but maybe surprised to see that agriculture and agriculture operations and related sciences, 2,270 full-time programs with doctoral degrees. These are things that determine where you end up playing, both as a country, and obviously this distribution is the institution as well, and that level of detail is. With regard to postgraduate studies and postgraduate students, there are about 150 odd thousand registered postgraduate students in our system. And again, mindful that our mandate, I'm not here to talk about the National Research Foundation, but about our science and research system. 150 odd thousand, you will see chairpersons in terms of honors, masters, and doctorates. The distribution, the highest proportion is obviously in the honors, and I believe some NISA carry the highest proportion, and many of those clients they are doing this part-time. So keep in mind those figures, chairperson, when you come into some of the details later. We work closely. We have for many years, we have known each other, Dr. Carlson and I, and between the MSF and the NRF, we complement. They look after the undergraduates. We do our best to look after the postgraduates. And we have been finding creative ways to our mandate is simple. We are here to support, promote, and advance research. And we do that by investing in people, particularly at the honors, masters, and doctoral level, provide research infrastructure, institutions, to researchers and scientists, academics, as well as give research grants to individuals who undertake research. And that has to operate as a single system. Because you can't give money to a student who is going to be supervised by somebody who doesn't have a research grant, who doesn't have a PhD, because then you're creating a problem for yourself. So you have to recognize the interdependence of all of these things that are working together. The demand, needless to say, chairperson, aspire to ensure that at least 20% of our post-graduate students are supported appropriately and adequately in this maintaining period. We're currently sitting at a less than 10%, as I was saying. But I'll just be very honest. That 10% will support them poorly. So, Randall gives you a grant for MS Plus. Prior to the introduction of the new policy, it would be about 80,000 or 85,000. The same student comes to NRF and asks for money to pursue honors or masters. And we give them 40,000. It doesn't make any sense. And create the impression that government doesn't think it has synergy in terms of its own policy. So your recall chairperson will change that policy and introduce in 2021. So the support that has been provided is really quite substantial. Similarly, we need to also increase the support that we give to our researchers, our academics, because you need them to be able to supervise. And we are suggesting that we ought to be targeting up to 50% success and funding rate for research proposals that we get within the next 10-year period. And let me explain in that context. And I'll just use the top one, the top table, by way of example. In 2018, we received 5,700 applications for research grants. Remember that there are 19,000 full-time 19,000 full-time academics, researchers and academics in the university system, full-time. And remember that 13,000 have got doctorates. So we've got 5,000 applicants. Of that 5,000 applicants, they have to go through a screening process. Look at the viability of the proposal, the rigor of the research that they're actually going to undertake. And we are currently set with about 2,600 fundable applications, the ones that pass the screening. And part of the work that we have to do together with the CHE, the Department of Science and Innovation, and DHEC, is to try and get as many of those to be fundable. What's about quality? Of those that were due to be fundable, 2,700 were funded. So we're looking at about 47% success rate. And part of what we would like to do is that over the next 10 years, we expect the number of those applications submitted to the NRF to increase, if not double, to say 10,000. But for us to be able to keep that 50% success rate, it does mean that we will need to find a great deal of resources. And I'll come back to the details. Chairperson, this is a case of detail. We do take the agenda very seriously, and part of what I was saying earlier is we want to increase the blue bar in terms of participation rate. And you can see the highest is from African females, that we get the 2017 data. Fundable and awarded, we want to try and keep those bars as close as possible, but obviously to have the proportion between the blue and the orange and the gray bar get slightly different because they're sitting there. The distribution in terms of race and gender. This is pretty much the same thing expressed slightly differently in terms of percentages. If you don't apply, you have no likelihood of getting any funding. And this is the distribution of the type of applications that we get from the different types of institutions. So the traditional universities are the ones that that's a function of many things. The issues that Ahmed was talking about in terms of teaching loads, the function of the fact that you have your doctorate or you don't, the fact that your institution encourages you to actually participate in the knowledge center science you're doing, undertaking research. And you'll see EOTs and some of the comprehensive institutions are not submitting the sort of numbers that you would anticipate. And this is just expressing it in percentage terms. Little dwelling on the issue of funding rates, Chairperson. And I want to use the top table this is not and should not be a surprise. In part because these are our research intensive institutions. Although the UCGs of this sort are not the ones that have the highest number of individuals with doctoral degrees. Because if you look back at the data, there are other institutions that have increased, but because of the choice of strategies that different institutions have made and encouragement to undertake research, that is why they are here. So by way of example, UCT asked 454 million, and this is 2017 data, versus a NISA who only asked for 20 million. So if you ask for less, you are unlikely to get more than the person who asked for more. So it goes in that way, and I think it's something that we want to keep it away from. Our website chairperson provides all the register of all the grants, the names of the individuals, the amount that has been allocated over the years, all there for members of our to look at. The number of research institutes that we supported, and this is 2017-18 data chairperson, is there. 4,600 grant holders, 13,000 students and postdocs, and that is what we are able to currently support. We indicated earlier the introduction of the new policy on postgraduate support, which will enhance the quality of access, success, and throughput by providing total cost of support to some students, will reduce the number of students that we are likely to support in 2023. So about 7,500. And in addition to some of the growth of our system in terms of growing, that is a bigger than way better than 10%, it would be probably about 5% of the national enrollment in postgraduates. Chairperson, the amount of money that we invest is very modest. I'm trying to convince Randall just to lend us $1 billion. Just $1 billion. Because if you look at the top line, in 2018, the nation spent less than $1 billion to support postgraduate students. Less than $1 billion. Our second major problem is that we are not investing in the early career research. Compared to that $900 million, we are spending $231 million to support young people who actually want to enter and become into professors. The established ones, 3,000 odd, we only have 188 million. The distribution is something that we are in discussion with our department because this is how the money comes to us. And we believe that this distribution really needs to be adjusted differently, even if you are not able to get more money into the system. This is the distribution right in the middle, chairperson, in terms of investment in knowledge areas, from agriculture, arts and humanities, social sciences, biological, chemical, all the way through to engineering, law, economics, mathematical sciences, health, finances, and the like. And again, it is about steering to make sure that we make investments that are appropriate. Chairperson, as I close, because the other slides I will all skip, you will see that the proportion of UCT or world students at the lion's share, the proportion has declined from 17% to 15%.
to look at it in terms of race and gender. This is what the profile currently looks like. So Jefferson et al. Conclude, because I'm going to skip the other slide. Our challenge is about growing the system. It's about responding to the mischief that I raised earlier about why we need it. It is about, I'm going to say, thinking differently about setting ourselves not just realistic but also ambitious goals. If we are to move our knowledge economy more and more ahead, it is incongruous for us to say that we will only be supporting as a country 5% of our postgraduate students, because we know that the nature of the support, the quantum of the support that you provide does lead to success. The evidence is clear from the undergraduate level that Randall and I talked about, and it is also supported at the postgraduate level, because when we actually support students properly, they do compete much quicker and they are able to enter the market.
Okay, thank you very much. That's all then. We have a statement. Let's move along. Those are the presentations, a lot of them. So we combine the infrastructure one with the funding for the
thank you, Chairman. I am Mokoni Lemboy, the principal of Malanga City College. My question relates to the infrastructure. I noted during the keynote address, Dr. Kwaka indicated that rightly so, that the CET is reliant on the funding from the department or from government, and also I noted that he also indicated that the CET is still focusing on academic programs, when it is true that we have to focus on the skill programs. Now, during the presentation, I thought I would see some lines wherein the CET comes in relation to the challenges that are mentioned above. Now, part of the presentation indicated the infrastructure for the tertiary colleges, as well as the infrastructure for the universities. And also there was an indication that they are engaging with the other structures like the public works, for the availability of the infrastructure so that they can be assisted. Now, the the challenge that they have raised or they have indicated that coming to the CBT is that when we talk of infrastructure in the CBT space, that is where now we have some challenges, but I did not see any line that is talking to the CBT infrastructure. Because in the CBT, when we talk of infrastructure, we start from the classroom level, the lecture level. Because currently we don't have our own infrastructure, we are relying on the GDP schools, whereas on daily basis we engage in trying to resolve the challenges or the threat that the GDP principals are giving to the sector to say they are inhibited, despite the protocol that was signed between the principals of the GDP and the ACT. So we have such challenges. Then we expect to see something that is related to the address of such challenges in the CET space. And also for the skills, some of the skills that we need to implement will require infrastructure as well. And you will find that we can't operate beyond or before 2 o'clock in some of the institutions because we have to wait for the DVD schools. The children must go out at 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock, is then that we can start. So these are the challenges that we are facing on the basis of the sector. Now we thought we will see somewhere wherein it is indicated that this is how the department is going to assist the CET infrastructure.
Okay.
So I'm checking on that line. And then lastly, the request, maybe you'll pardon me, hold that in advance if maybe I'm out of line, to say, based on the presentation that we had, there was no way the CET came in from the funding, the impact of the fund as well as the infrastructure. So we are requesting, if possible, to see can there be a dedicated day from your office, Chairperson, with regards to the discussions about CET options, so that maybe a lot of challenges that are there can be addressed. Thank you.
Higher education institutions
and private institutions, we don't talk about private providers. I think we need to also look at what is the possibility in terms of space for looking at issues of access, in particular in access as a way. And then the other issue that we need to speak about is how do we address, I mean, we heard about research, and we know that a big challenge that we have is beating the numbers as far as PhD or doctoral degrees are concerned. What is the reason why we're funding large amounts to foreign nationals instead of our own local people? Can you provide us with an answer there? Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, thank you very much. I'm Mohammed from the Alliance for Academic Success, and I'm going to actually go a little bit different, although interviewers will probably expect me to talk about books. I'm going to start off by saying, I'm probably, after looking at the audience and listening to the conversation today, I realize that I'm probably one of the few people who represent and who supply your institution. And I think that that's something that is missing in this room today. Yes, I understand that there's a lot of criticism and suspicion around business, especially after you have companies like Steinhoff or KPMG in our history. But we are the critical part, and I think that what today has been about is getting bang for our buck. We're spending a lot of money, we're putting a lot of money into this, but the part that we're not talking about is the people who provide the services. When you've got that money at the institution, why is it that it's not doing the work that it wants? And I think that that's a big part of the challenge. As an SMME, as a business that's been working with a range of institutions over here, one of the key problems that we have is that the administrative capacity, sometimes it's just the will. And it's normally at middle management at a lot of our TVET colleges and our universities, when we want to do business with them and want to provide the services, is actually lacking. As mentioned, projects get left half done. The quality of maintenance may be issues. But a large part of that is not necessarily the choice of service providers, but very often it is the institutions that don't pay on time, don't provide proper scope of work, don't provide timely information, and those become costs that the businesses now factor in there. The businesses now charge a lot more, and this is the good businesses. I'm not talking about the ones who are looking to milk the system. The good businesses are reaching a point where they don't want to do business with institutions that are difficult to do business with. They avoid that. And what it does is it leaves a situation where the institutions are paying a lot more for something that they should be getting. And this is not the funding part of it, of where we're going to get the money. It's about when we have the money, are we getting bang for our buck? When we talk about building accommodation, the private sector would be more than happy to do that, but it takes too long. The return on the investment and the risk that you take, you have to factor into cost, and that just becomes very, very expensive to the entire ecosystem. Instead of spending X amount on something that we should be able to get, it's costing us double, because the risk factor of doing business with institutions is getting higher and higher every day. We as an SMME have had many instances where we're talking and we're waiting for money to be paid to us for 3 months and 6 months. And it's purely administrative. It's someone who doesn't want to process a piece of paper. And that's where the money is actually costing us a lot more. Among the other issues is the fact that a lot of the institutions I fear are reaching a point of overcrowding, whether it's security, whether it is our infrastructure and buildings, whether it is our maintenance. The institutions have an X amount of space. It's like a hospital. And sorry, I go back to that because I'm a pharmacist by training. There's only so many beds. It's built in so many rooms. When you get to a certain point and you start putting more and more people in there, you're going to run into the problems of security, maintenance, risk. You know, a bathroom is only meant, a toilet is only meant to be flushed so many times a day. But if you put twice as many people through it, it's going to fail. It's not because of anything more than we are putting too many people into the same amount of space. My point that I want to get at, and maybe this is where I'm coming from, is there's a very, very big distrust of business and the people who provide the services. And I understand why. But there's going to have to be an opening to be able to say, talk to the people, check them out, speak to the people in the industry, find out that you're working with the credible people, and talk to them and find out what is it that is the challenge, what is it that is actually happening on the ground, what is happening in the middle management. And that's where I think sometimes there's a disconnect. We don't deal with people at the head of the institution. We've got to deal with people who are administrators, people who are middle managers, who sometimes demotivate the people that we've got to deal with. And that's where the bottleneck and the backlog come from. And it may sound, kind of self-serving, but at the end of the day, I'm a parent, I'm a graduate from an institution, my wife is an academic. I understand this because I'm there. I see more students from different institutions because we deal with multiple institutions. So thank you very much for the opportunity, Chair, for inviting me, and I hope that that was a valuable contribution.
Thank you very much. The last person, Honorable Kash. Thank you very much, Chair. I actually would like to give my opportunity to speak to young people at the back of the room to speak, because it's rare that they have opportunities like this to engage in spaces like this. But I think this 2 points to the department with what you present in regards to infrastructure. I think right now we're near the end of this academic year and approach the following. I'm quite worried with regards to in particular institutions like UniBay and whether or not we'll see the same issues with the block toilets, or not even block toilets, with the mobile toilets that are full. We're going to be seeing the same issues with the students that are sleeping eight in a really dilapidated room. So what's our plan over the next few months leading to the next academic year to sort of mitigate the same crisis that we had last year? And then thank you very much to the NRF for the stats that you gave us. I'm truly appreciating many of the various demographics that are highlighted. So Chair, I'll just talk about my opportunity to the rest of my opportunity to speak to the young people.
Thank you very much for the opportunity and for being part of this meeting. One of the questions.
Who the mic?
My name is Vanessa Mohamed. I'm local SLP 4th GT and G6 campus. The two questions that I have is for the HMDGT planning. Now, on page 33 for the MIF platform, you give us a screenshot, but my question is, how often is that updated when it comes to the infrastructure, the supporting documents, as well as the report, and also the evaluation on page 23? What is the time, like the time frame, what is that based on? Because there's so much that you can do and evaluate something, but what is your time frame on that? And lastly, the second speaker, I fully agree that before we focus on the fourth industrial revolution, we need to actually look at the learning that comes from primary school, secondary, tertiary, because I am a second year student and we feel overwhelmed with everything that we're being prepared for the industry, but we're not equipped enough for to use the computers or the software so that we can actually participate with the other countries. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'm trying to rush that you go to the house at least by 4. Just 2 points for my side, We're here for a very big challenge with the accommodation of students, primarily because we rely mainly on student contacts at university. Enough of that. reallocation, adjustment, the adjustment appropriation bill, the thick book that gets submitted. So I noticed that there's about 400 million in the Department of Higher Education from the student branch that is being taken back to China, that the department is not going to spend. I was quite shocked. I was shocked because we always complain that the TVET branch, the TVET colleges are not sufficiently funded. And yet we've got 400 million that is not to the revenue fund because it has not been spent. 325 of that amount is reallocated. I think it's around that constitute 1.9 million or so. Now it got me worried. I know that next week or week after next, we have asked the department to brief us on the adjustment. So it's something that will come out. I would like to get some comments now since we're discussing funding. And there is a huge amount of money that has not been spent. I think it's around, it's in the infrastructure program, if I'm not mistaken. So can I please get somebody to speak to that issue? But otherwise, what's the question? Okay, Dr. Parker, maybe we should start.
I think the first one about the PET, I think that the points were really well made. My understanding was the one is not a baseline infrastructure fund, but it is something that bottom of that in terms of how to refund the expansion of baseline. One of the things in the national plan, post-school education and training that will come through, is this idea of education precincts, where we start putting together risk campuses, activity campuses, and PET campuses, and have shared infrastructure that can be utilized in our campuses. With respect to the work that we're doing with the Department of Public Works and so on, that is infrastructure looking for a whole system. It's not for, it's not just for universities or senior countries, it's also for CET. And if we can identify spaces which can be developed, they could be utilized today. But perhaps I would request that Dr. Saul actually answer that more directly in terms of the company discussion program. I think there is something there, it's not happening on the internet.
Just to add what Dr. Parker was saying, the simple part of the reason why the CBT infrastructure was under discussion is because there is no allocation for infrastructure facility, and therefore we have to start, we can only discuss the funding for infrastructure facility if there is an allocation. Before the allocation was made for TVET, there was no discussion for infrastructure in Kirin's
what an overview of what the major security needs are. There are some institutions that have real challenges. For example, I'm thinking about UNICEF. UNICEF doesn't have lighting in some places, and that makes it dangerous to walk at night. We see the same issue somewhere and other campuses, and they are currently putting together a plan to deal with those particular challenges. So the issue of infrastructure safety and security has been looked at, but again, it is something that takes time to implement. But it is a critical area. The issue of the business relationship, this is a critical area that I was talking about in terms of client delivery management and procurement processes, because that's what we see. We see when institutions are unable to manage the delivery of the client, the providers. Things go out of sync. Things take longer to take, they don't fund, they can't pay properly, etc. So that's a critical part of the focus that we put into the macro infrastructure framework. And we're supporting institutions now to identify what kind of skills do they need to be able to do this and manage it properly. You can even come down to supporting institutions to identify what the database for managing it. And then helping them to develop a procurement policy that makes sense for infrastructure so that these things can be aligned. It's not an easy thing, and it's absolutely critical. So contract management and procurement is something I think across government that's important. The issue about student housing and the quality of student housing across the system, it is a challenge, and it will remain a challenge. We officially on those kind of changes and our rural station at the moment was fixed as pilot. Renewable campus, union campus, and so on. I think the pictures that you showed, I actually got a report from UniBank, which I'll share with you. They were old pictures. They have done a lot of work in terms of what is there, but the problem of overcrowding remains as long as we don't have sufficient student accommodation. And I think that's also where we particularly in rural campuses have to look at how we can create even more accelerated focus. And you will know that we, as I indicated, we've got a number of projects. The other one, Chair, around the contact and distance or using IT, I think this is on our name as well, that we have to take, we have to start working on that. We've got a project in the department that I'm now going to talk to you more about in terms of an open learning platform to support you for teams. But the critical problem we're facing at the moment, I think all of our institutions, particularly in postgraduate, are starting to engage in IT teaching and learning platforms. But the critical problem in the undergrad is the success of students on these platforms. So we want to look at what the teaching and learning pedagogical issues are to be able to support that. Opening up massive spaces to online services without giving support to students to see is also not going to be effective utilization of our funding.
Thank you, Eugene, and thank you, yes, we do have a national open learning system, which is currently being planned for development, and the system should be available by next year, maybe about next year. And this system has got two components. One is what we call a repository of learning materials. And we've already started developing learning materials for, say, electrician learning materials for So we've started developing some materials centrally. We are hoping that we will have a very broad material repository that will be shared across the system, so that if one TVET college, for example, prepares very good learning materials, then this can be used and shared by others. The matters around intellectual property, copyright, and so on have been given a lot of attention, and so that's the one part of it. Now the other part of it is about the learning management system. And the idea there is that a learner or a student, say who's at a TVET college, is enrolled for NCV, level 4, I'll give you an example. Then that student is able to do program, to enroll online and study online. But as Dr. Parker mentioned, we are very, very hesitant about making it 100% online program because of the risks of success and because of the students that require support. So the idea is to try and promote as much as possible what we call blended learning. And the idea of blended learning is to ensure that there's both contact with the learners for engagement and so on, as well as distance through online. So, Chair, that is the vision we are starting now.
Chair, the last question I'd like to ask our CFO, and particularly to answer.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, for submitting this. The matter relates to the declared underspending of infrastructure funds in the adjusted estimates. Now, for this purpose, Chair, may I just firstly note that all departments were required by National Treasury based on fiscal pressures to declare either on the one side unspent funds at the time of the adjusted estimates, or secondly, the possibility of unspent funds by the end of the financial year. So for our purpose, and in collaboration with the university branch as well as the TVET branch, the risk of underspending on infrastructure funds were identified, mainly because of slow spending on the side of institutions. And to prevent the possibility of fiscal dumping from our side by simply just transferring those funds to the institutions and the funds not being spent at ground level, the decision, together with National Treasury, was taken to say that we will rather declare those funds now under spending so that we prevent fiscal dumping and that we will look into those projects in the future. Thank you.
There really isn't any large investment in funding for NCVs. What I think is often mistaken is that there is a reasonably large enrollment of foreign students in our university system. The higher you go, the higher the proportion. So at the doctoral level, we work more proportionally to foreign students. Firstly, because we have a strong university system. And secondly, you might remember, that in 95 we signed a Catholic Education Training Protocol and ratified it in Parliament, which is a commitment that we made as a country to the rest of the continent. We said again, we included one
we should have expected for this type of student funding, or would it just give me a better position? And later on, given the Tibet, and then given the construction. But we thought that all of these things are interrelated, so we should give it all of them at once. But I think it's proven that we require a lot more time. Maybe it took the expression. But I think we have done what we have to do today. We have done justice to the subject. Unfortunately, people's lunch, people tend to be in the day. I still don't understand why. But yeah, people rush to the airport, take flights back home. Next time we'll ask them when they mean, but they please make sure that your flights are being late so that you don't have to be in rush. Because it's important that everybody is here for the institutions. But I think it is going very well. I would like to thank all of you participants, the honorable members of the ASC who are next. The other members went to the house. Probably the party line. When you are needed in the house, the chief would say, but come, what is the man? So people have no choice. So thank you everybody. I'm sure it has been quite an experience coming here. So we have agreed that every quarter we will do this. Identify a topic, plan around, and have a session. Information sharing, but also a platform to engage people about know the issues in the sector. But it's all contributing toward the conversations that we as members of Parliament like to facilitate this space. But sometimes things happen because we don't create enough platforms for us to talk to each other. That's why we invite the student leadership.